It is Sunday, June 30th, 2013, and this is episode 24 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As a reminder, this podcast is sponsored by me and does not reflect the opinions or plans of my employer. I really hope everyone is having a great summer so far. It's been pretty good for me so far, so I am looking forward to a very short week coming up. Here in the States, we have the Independence Day holiday, where, as you probably know, we get to celebrate our independence by blowing up miscellaneous stuff in our driveways. Well, I have a freight train of news this week, so I'm going to go ahead and get started now. The first is a story on netsecurity.org about a recent report from Kaspersky, and the report apparently was intended to compare how many pieces of malware the average executive thinks there are versus what's really out there. And while that's interesting, I find the number of actual malware samples being found on a daily basis to be the most interesting part of the report. Apparently, Kaspersky is saying there are 200,000 unique malware variants being released on a daily basis. I find that number just absolutely incredible. So, unfortunately, I can't actually find the Kaspersky report, so I haven't been able to read the report itself, but as soon as I can, I'll talk about that in an upcoming episode. The next story is kind of a two-in-one. Hopefully by now you've heard about the Carburp Trojan. And recently there's been some news about Carburp being for sale online for anywhere between $50,000 and $5,000. Well, apparently it all went to hell last week when someone published the source code in an encrypted zip file, and someone else apparently published the password to that zip file, and so now the complete source code of this Trojan and its associated CNC application are floating around on the internet. So I think that's kind of ties into the last story, in that we would expect to see a whole bunch of new variants of Carburp coming out. And we saw that a while back. I believe it was the Zeus source code was disclosed quite some time ago, and that spawned a couple of new variants, which are still kicking around today. But one of the interesting things that happens when source code like this is disclosed is sometimes we find vulnerabilities. And in this particular case, a researcher found a pretty bad vulnerability in the CNC application for Carburp. There's a blog post on the Xylobox website. I think you say it Xylobox. I'm not entirely sure. In any event, this post goes on to describe a remote code execution bug. Basically, one of the parameters that the command and control application takes in is an object, and the command and control basically evaluates that object. So you can feed it whatever you want, and the researcher here actually goes through some pretty painstaking analysis and writes some proof of concept code that you can readily download, which will give you the credentials to log in to the CNC application, lots of other badness. You can upload your own web shells and, you know, basically own the command and control server. It makes me wonder if there's lots of organized crime gangs running around trying to compromise each other's botnet CNC hosts. Well, I don't think we've heard the last of this one. We'll see what happens as more people have time to take a look at the code and we start to see some additional variants pop up based on the CarBurp source code. Next up is a story on Bloomberg about FINRA. FINRA is the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, and they are reporting that they are seeing a proliferation of complaints about cybersecurity breaches in their member organizations. And to net it out, what appears to be happening for the most part is the end clients of these companies, so basically individual investors, retirees, that sort of thing, are having their email accounts compromised, and in turn the bad guys are resetting credentials or otherwise using that email account to connect to and take over investment accounts with these companies. The article is a little ambiguous about where the real blame lies for this. It sounds like, in a lot of cases, the companies are pretty eager to help out, and in doing so, they unwittingly help the attackers. And it sounds like, in most cases, these companies are making the end victim whole again by restoring their funds, but that basically means the companies are eating the losses. So it kind of says to me that something is going to have to change, and change pretty soon. All right, the next story is about an attack on the FT, Financial Times, by the Syrian Electronic Army. Back in May, the FT had their website and Twitter feed compromised and was posting pro-Syrian government articles. So basically the exact same thing that's happened to many, many others. Now, in the same vein as The Onion, one of the reporters at the FT wrote a tell-all about the attack, and it's really, really good. I'll talk about it here, but I highly recommend you find the link in the show notes and go read it for yourself. The attack started out with the personal email account of some FT employee sending an email to a couple of FT employees' business accounts or work accounts with a link to a CNN article. But, of course, the CNN article was a misdirected link. It was an HTML email. So while it looked like a link to CNN, it actually took the visitor to a hacked WordPress site. And that hacked WordPress site in turn redirected to a phishing page that looked like a legitimate login page for their email. And their email was hosted by Google, so not entirely difficult to fake. So apparently one of the FT employees that received this phishing email fell for it and logged in with his or her email credentials to the fake site. And the way the site was set up, the way the phishing site was set up, you didn't actually realize what had happened. After you logged in, it actually took you to your email, but in the background, of course, it was recording your login ID and password. So once the attackers had the login ID and password, they, of course, logged in and had access to the internal mail directory of the rest of the FT employees, and they started sending around a similar phishing email with a similar misdirected link. And the reporter who wrote this article apparently got that second email and recognized that it was a fish because it apparently didn't take him to where he thought once he clicked on the link and reported it. And so the IT department sent out an email warning people about the attack, and in particular to ignore phishing emails. Well, of course, the attackers had access to at least one or two internal email accounts at this point, and received that email and turned around and faked another email from the support desk using the same from address and look and feel as the original IT department email, basically as a follow-up to the first email that everybody needed to log into the site and reset their password. Well, of course, the link that it took you to when you followed the instructions in the IT email was another phishing page. So at this point, some people inside the FT who had access to the WordPress and Twitter accounts for the FT fell for the attack, and at that point the Syrian Electronic Army was able to actually perform password resets on their Twitter and WordPress accounts, and it was off to the races. Pro-Syrian propaganda was posted all over the place, and the rest is history. So ironically, the FT had just moved the year before over to Google for email, and they had the ability to use two-factor authentication, but they hadn't used it yet. So now they are moving to two-factor with all due speed, and it's interesting to see what I'll call a normal user in the form of this reporter being such a big proponent for two-factor. You don't usually see that kind of thing from the rank and file. Usually it's viewed as an inhibitor, but I think in this case, once you've been through the pain, you start to see the value. So I'm really, really glad that the FT shared the story. I think it's really good for everybody to see how these attacks are being perpetrated and to give us some ideas on how we can protect ourselves. I think I mentioned it before, in addition to leveraging two-factor where you can, some other ideas would be to isolate where you can access your really sensitive things. In the case of the FT, it was their Twitter account and their WordPress accounts. Maybe in their case it would make sense to have those isolated and on a different set of computers or virtual machines or what have you, where you can't check your normal email and you don't have this ability of cross-contamination. Although I'm not entirely sure how well that would have worked in this case, you probably would have needed an off-domain email address for your WordPress and Twitter accounts for password resets and whatnot. Otherwise, it's conceivable that even that isolated system would have gotten a copy of the phishing email and somebody still may have fallen for it. So you really have to think this through on how you're going to design and implement the right levels of protection to guard against this kind of thing. The good news is it's not impossible. It is going to be a little less convenient. But again, if it's important to you, you can find ways to make it work. And conversely, if the downside is not as bad as the productivity gains you get, then you'll continue on in the way you've been working. So again, it's all risk management, right? All right, the next story is somewhat related. Kaspersky released a report citing an 87% year-over-year increase in phishing attacks. Given the recent spate of stories, I don't think that's entirely surprising. Not a lot else to say about that report. It's interesting. I'd recommend reading it. I think it highlights an important trend in the industry that we really need to be cognizant of. You know, we are enamored with our IPS devices and our next-gen firewalls and our antivirus engines and whatnot. And at the same time, the attackers are increasingly using just plain vanilla phishing attacks, whether with a malware attachment or, like we saw with the FT, some kind of dummy logon page to steal credentials. You're not going to catch that with an IPS or a firewall, or in many cases an antivirus engine either. And speaking of losing battles, the next story is about Google's recent transparency report. The net of the story is that hacked legitimate sites are actually worse than purpose-built malicious sites. So Google says that they are tracking, as of June 9th, 3,891 malicious sites, or basically sites that were set up for the express purpose of doing bad stuff. And at the same time, about 39,247 hacked sites. So that's obviously an order of magnitude more hacked sites. And the other point they raise is that it takes an average of 50 days for one of these hacked sites to be fixed once they're notified. So CNET and Brian Krebs both have a really good analysis of this data, so I recommend you take a look at those links in the show notes. And then, similar but related, Sophos is reporting to V3 that they count about 30,000 small to medium enterprise websites per day being hacked. And that seems to be a little bit at odds with what Google reports. I'm not sure who I believe. But in any event, the point is still that normal websites are being compromised to deliver malware. So oftentimes these are called watering hole attacks, specifically when the people who visit a particular website are your target demographic that you're trying to go after, you know, going after the Council on Foreign Relations to get at foreign policy people, as an example. Presumably, if you're hacking a hardware store's website, it's probably not really going to qualify as a watering hole attack. So I grouped these three stories together because I think they highlight something that I've talked about quite a lot here. I think we are approaching a point where we really have to do something different. Clearly, there's still attacks happening using all of the old ways, but more and more people are being attacked, whether it's by email or by their web browser. They're being attacked directly, and they're bypassing all of your security infrastructure. It's getting past your mail filters, it's getting past your spam filters, your virus filters, your firewalls, your IDS, IPS engines. It's getting past all of that stuff. Now, absolutely, there are ways to mitigate it, right? You can put in web filtering that blocks unknown sites or unclassified sites. And so basically that would catch any site that recently popped up on the internet, and presumably that will catch things that are hosting, you know, phishing sites that were just set up for a particular run. And so even maybe if a site, legitimate site, was hacked and had a iframe injection to one of these attack sites, presumably your web filter would block it, right? But that's not 100%. I've seen a number of situations where it's just not feasible to block unknown sites because people access lots of intranet sites. And I know it sounds really easy to whitelist intranet sites, but I assure you, in the situations I've seen, it's not feasible. And you've got two-factor authentication, which is cumbersome and expensive to deploy. and you have application whitelisting, which will help protect against unknown malware, where antivirus tends to fall down. And that's generally pretty good. As we've seen with Bit9, it's not perfect. It can be itself exploited, and it's also expensive and cumbersome to operate. So I think we're really rapidly approaching a point where some drastic changes have to be made in the way companies operate on the internet. And I don't think any company necessarily has it solved, so there's lots of opportunity here. And the next story is somewhat related about admin rights and basically the perennial struggle between IT and the user population over whether to remove admin rights on workstations. And it's always a very unpopular thing. I've worked in environments where we have had admin rights and where we have not had admin rights. I've managed IT in both scenarios for relatively large environments, and I've seen the pros and cons of both. This particular article is in the Telegraph, and it raises some interesting points. Generally, that the people who oppose it most are often the ones who need it the most, right? So your executives, your salespeople, these people are generally going to be inconvenienced. They may feel entitled. They may believe that they are invulnerable, what have you. They're often both pretty significant influencers in IT policy, and also don't want that kind of a thing applied to their own work system. One of the problems I have with the article is they quote a survey of IT decision makers on whether they believe removing admin rights would increase or decrease IT costs. And I think the number was 50% of decision makers said it would reduce the cost. And the problem I have with that is it's totally subjective. What I would really like to see, and I've never actually seen to date, and I've been kicking around in IT for a long time, are hard objective numbers on what it costs to remove admin rights on maybe a per person per year basis. Because frankly, I don't give a crap what a bunch of IT decision makers think about removing admin rights. I'd really like to know what it actually costs. Now, I'm personally very conflicted about removing admin rights. On the upside, it will oftentimes stop people from shooting themselves in the foot. So if you don't have admin rights, you can't install a VNC client and server, which opens your system wide open to remote control if you connect to a coffee shop wireless network. And by the way, I have indeed seen that. And also, it stops people from deactivating your tools. So your management applications, your patch applications, inventory applications, those sorts of things, you can have some kind of assurance that they are running because the end user doesn't have the ability to tamper with them. Obviously, the downsides are that it takes substantially more support resources, because now anytime someone wants to install an application on their system, they need to call the help desk. I would also call the fact that you generally have to use Active Directory a downside unto itself, because when we look at most all of the really devastating breaches, Active Directory has been a really critical pivot point inside the organization that the attackers used. So the attacker got on, they harvested some credentials that allowed them to hop around the network more or less with impunity, because They had local cache credentials on the workstation. They were able to sniff credentials. They were able to use the credentials that were on the system itself to log into other systems and propagate out. Now, one of the advantages, going back to the advantage of removing admin rights, is people, again, can't install software which may potentially have malware. But I will tell you, I have seen a trend, and I can't quantify it, but I have seen some examples where malware doesn't actually need admin rights to run. It will run in the context of the user. So just by way of example, if you are on a Windows system and you don't have admin rights, you can't install something. You can't install an application into the program files or the program files x86 directory. You can't modify the WinNT directory and those types of directories, but you can run executables in your local directory. So you could download a little self-contained executable program, put it into your local directory, and assuming there are no other policy preventions in place, you can run it. And because of that, you can also run a virus that would run in the context of your user. And they're out there. They will install themselves in the user's startup profile and maintain persistence that way. They're not generally infecting the system at a very low level. Obviously, many systems have unpatched privilege escalation bugs, because we all know that privilege escalation bugs are very low priority and don't really need to be patched. Now, I'll also say that I have been in environments where it is just really not practical to remove admin rights, no matter what the cost, because of the kinds of things people need to do on a daily basis. So if you take, for instance, a consultant, that consultant may need to install applications many times a day, and it's really not practical. You may have people connecting to different company networks and need to modify their hosts file or some other privileged aspect of their system on a frequent basis, in an ad hoc basis, and it's really not practical to have them call into a help desk every time they need to do that. I was at a conference a couple of years ago, and a large company that was there had somebody who I was talking to describing how they operate, and most people operate without administrator rights. This particular person, because of the nature of his job, had administrator rights, but what he was describing is that in their company, if you retain administrator rights, you go through a much more rigorous scrutiny process. So on, I believe it was a monthly or a quarterly basis, his laptop goes through a really thorough analysis by a forensic examiner to determine if it's been compromised. As I recall, that company was into some relatively important lines of business, so they could probably justify that kind of expense. But it was a large company, and so you could imagine that there were a fair number of people who fell into that program. So something to think about, whether or not you allow admin rights in your organization. All right, before I move on to the next phase of the program, I want to jump back to the V3 article. I forgot to mention something that I thought was really important. At the very bottom of the article, and it's somewhat tangential, the author goes on to talk about how there is a general lack of cybersecurity skills. And one of the quotes in here, I think, is just fantastic. And the quote is, "We need general awareness, like the health and safety or sex education campaigns in school. We need that basic societal understanding about how to be good net citizens and we are not doing a good enough job at that. I think that's very well said, and I think that is definitely an area that as a civilization we're going to have to address. Otherwise, we're going to constantly be behind the curve. All right, the next story is from Ars Technica. It is about the trade-off between password complexity and password length. And this story was sent to me by a coworker of mine, and I thought it was worth talking about here. So it is generally conventional wisdom that passwords need to be complex, and you know what I see in many organizations is an increased push towards complexity, but basically holding the line on length. So we tend to be stuck at 8 characters, and you know, we are continually trying to increase the complexity with requiring capital letters and special characters and numbers and basically one of all the different food groups. But in the end, those are just much harder for people to remember. And so you have to ask the question, how much better is it really if people are going to take those super complex patterns and make something that's memorable for themselves? So, yeah, I might have a password that has special characters and numbers and letters, but it's going to be 4 exclamation points, a capital A, and a B, C, D, E. And, you know, that's meeting the requirements, but not actually very secure. So it really is much better to focus on length than complexity. And that's basically what this study is bearing out. You can read the details. Link is in the show notes. I am in complete agreement with this article. If you're interested, I had played with this a while ago before I turned my life over to KeePass. There's a password strategy called Diceware. And Diceware basically, as you might expect, involves using a couple of dice to identify some random numbers, and those random numbers look up a sequence of words, and you string those words together, and they're relatively memorable. But because the password is really long, even if someone knew you were using this Diceware strategy, the number of permutations is just astronomical. And while I have a buzz and I'm on a roll, I would also like to point out that a lot of people don't fully grasp how passwords work and what the vulnerability strategies are, right? So you have, on the one hand, what I'll call the black box. And that basically is some application where you can log in. You can't actually see what's inside the black box. And in those cases, relatively short passwords are okay because presumably you're not going to allow an arbitrary number of tries. So obviously if you do allow an arbitrary number of tries, it's probably still going to be rate limited somehow. You're not going to be able to try 100 million permutations per second. In many cases, the system will lock out an account after 5 or 10 tries. And so in that particular case, a short password with some complexity is okay. But what's happening is that applications are not really black box anymore, even when we think they are. So your web application may have its user database protected, and you may lock out accounts after a certain number of tries. But if there is an SQL injection vulnerability, somebody can download your password table and go to town with John the Ripper. And they will be able to try hundreds of millions of permutations per second, and they will be coming up with matches. and your 8-character password with all the complexity in the world is not going to cut it. So I say remove the complexity requirements and change the minimum password length to, say, 16 characters, and let people come up with memorable ways of recalling their long passwords. All right, now I'm going to do something I swore I would never do, and that is talk politics. So obviously there has been a lot of crap going on. Edward Snowden has really turned the world on its head and continues to do so on an almost daily basis. Most recently, I think his leaks have really gotten the European Union and some other countries totally pissed off at the United States. But that's not really what I want to talk about. The first story I have about this is pretty interesting. So obviously most other parts of the world are, number one, pretty skeptical about the United States' growing paranoia with all things terrorism. And these leaks really have played into that fear. And so now the concern is that non-US companies, and maybe even some US companies, are going to start looking elsewhere for their IT services. If companies in the European Union think that they're being monitored by the NSA if they use Amazon Web Services or Skype or Google, they're probably going to start using some local services, or at least services in a country that they're less skeptical of. And the Telegraph has an article basically in line with that, describing how a lot of European companies who are basically niche players in the same markets as some of the dominant US companies have seen a pretty dramatic growth in sales since these leaks have been disclosed. And I would fully expect that to continue. And I, to be perfectly frank, am pretty worried about the United States' dominant position in the technology world because of these leaks. You know, right, wrong, or indifferent, I think the unintended consequence of both the activities and the leaks are going to threaten this country's position in the world. The second story is from the New York Times, and the title is NSA Leaks Put Focus on System Administrators. And this is something that has been on my radar for a while. A lot of regulatory agencies, especially in the US, have a lot of focus on controlling and monitoring what administrators do. So that's something that's been near and dear to my heart for a while. But this has really put a lens like never before on it. How could a contract sysadmin for the NSA come by all this information without the great, all-powerful, all-knowing NSA actually seeing it and obviously letting him flee the country with the data? This is really something that needs to be paid attention to by most companies of any size. And clearly, if you're a one-person IT shop, you know, you probably don't have a lot of care about this area. But if you are an IT shop that has hundreds or thousands of people, this is really going to hit home. The NSA, in their case, they are apparently going to be implementing a two-man rule for system administrators. I am really, really interested to see how that works. Obviously, because if it works for them and they come up with a workable model, I'd personally be interested in understanding how they do it. One aspect of this article really has me kind of terrified, though. And there's a quote in here from Robert Bigman, the former CIO of the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, and he says, quote, when you log on with a root account, it doesn't know if you're staff employee or a contract employee. It just knows you're root. You're known as super user. You have all privileges, unquote. The thing that frightens me most is that kind of says that they don't use some really basic things like sudo. I'll tell you, in every company I've been with, getting people to stop logging in with root has been job one, and getting them to use sudo exclusively is very, very important in any kind of a large IT organization. So in this case, you either have a situation where the CIO doesn't know what the heck's going on in his shop, or they are actually doing something really dumb. And I don't know which one is worse. So as with the other stories, this link is in the show notes. I encourage you to read it. The last story I have is from NBC News, and the net of it is that a former general named Cartwright is now under investigation for disclosing Stuxnet. So I think Stuxnet has been talked about to death, but I think that now we can all stop pretending to not know where it came from. And apparently the news that he was under investigation has been leaked. So I don't specifically think it was part of Edward Snowden's leak, but anything's possible. The last thing I wanted to talk about was someone in Twitter asked me a question to talk about Google. Specifically, the question was about my thoughts on Google being demanded to hand over emails without a warrant. And to my knowledge, Google hasn't handed over any information without a warrant. I think the problem has been about the scope of the warrants that have been issued. So, for instance, with the very first leak, which was a FISA order to Verizon, basically to turn over the metadata for all of their phone records, right? Whether it was domestic to domestic, domestic to international, or international to domestic, they wanted it all. And so we would expect probably to see similar demands placed upon the likes of Google and others. And the challenge is, as we know, these FISA orders come with a gag order, so you can't actually talk about the fact that you got one of these, or you're actually breaking the law. Now, clearly, if I'm wrong and Google is indeed handing over email without a warrant, I think that's a bad thing, and I would expect that that's probably going to get them into some trouble with the likes of the EFF and the ACLU and others. But my read of the situation is that the FISA court really has no problem approving wiretap orders, so I can't imagine that any government agency is really going to have a problem getting a warrant expediently to cover whatever scope they want. Now, I will say there has been some very late developments. So some of the additional slides, apparently in the same slide deck as the initial three or four, came out. And it looks like the situation might not be quite as bad as originally portrayed. Although, you know, there's always this question about, you know, what is the full scope of what's being vacuumed up by the NSA. We may never actually know that, but I think it was indicated that they had somewhere around 120,000 targets in their PRISM system. So obviously the operators of the system could query data on any one of these subjects, and I presume it's probably pretty easy to add new subjects to the list. But the net point for me was, you know, it's not 300 million people. It's 121,000 or 120 however many thousand. which is still a very big number. And you do have to wonder what kinds of people are on that list. Are they political activists? Are they podcasters like me? You know, who knows? But as I mentioned, I don't like to talk about politics, but I will tell you, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and I remember the Berlin Wall falling. I remember very clearly the time before the Berlin Wall fell. I remember my parents telling me about East Berlin and about people dying to get across the wall, and I mean literally dying. And I remember hearing about the papers please culture, and I remember hearing about the Stasi and the culture of espionage and spying and people being paid to spy on their neighbors and underground bunkers filled with file cabinets of information. And, you know, that always seemed like somewhere else. That was communist Russia, that was Germany, that was East Berlin. But damn, what has happened to our country? It makes me very sad to think about what has happened. And, you know, maybe it's been like this for a very long time and we just never really knew about it. I just hope over time cooler heads will prevail, that we lose our utter paranoia over all things terrorism, and we start to really recognize that a lot of people that came before us died so that we could have liberty and privacy and the freedoms that we've come to expect in this country and in other parts of the world had come to respect us for. We have a good democracy, and I am thoroughly hopeful and will be always optimistic that we can turn it around. It may take some time. The new generation of people, I think, are much more skeptical of authority than my generation and previous generations. So, you know, as these people start to mature and take on leadership positions, we may see some of this stuff turn around. And I hope we do. Now, I know one of the aspects that a lot of people don't have their eyes on, and I'm sure I don't fully understand it either, is the totality of what people like the president and the director of national intelligence and the NSA have to contend with and have to do in order to keep this country safe. And I will bet that most, if not all, of these people have the best intentions in their heart. I would expect that every one of them thinks they're doing the right thing. And, you know, certainly if something bad happened and they turned a blind eye to, you know, something that could have prevented that, they personally would feel devastated, I'm sure of it. So this is not a simple situation. And one of the reasons I'm not cut out for politics, I really don't know how I would handle that type of situation. But all in all, it's still a great country. There's a lot of great people here. There's a lot of beautiful things to see, a lot of great things to do. It's still, despite what you read, relatively sane throughout most of the country. Certainly some places are crazier than others. And I can't imagine wanting to live anywhere else. And, you know, again, I think it will turn around over time. Maybe not in my lifetime, but hopefully in my kids' lifetimes or their kids' lifetimes, we'll find our way. Well, I appreciate everyone listening to my rambling here. I'm going to cut it off for the week. I hope everyone has a great week. For those of you in the U.S., happy 4th of July. I hope you enjoy your time off. Hopefully you get some time off. And I will talk to you again next week. In the meantime, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at DefensiveSec. You can find us on the internet at www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find the show notes and whatnot There you can send me an email, info@defensivesecurity.org. I love talking to people about security and whatnot. And with that, I will talk to you all next week. Have a great one. Bye.